Hello world! Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key. My colleague is Joe King, and we're heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is www.pcradioshow.org. Everything old is new again. Remember vinyl records? Besides their audio qualities, vinyl records are optical and tactile. The consumer can appreciate their musical purchase in a physical world, which allows for a greater sense of nostalgia. What we know as vinyl records, which are more broadly gramophone records, really are made from vinyl. Polyvinyl chloride, to be precise, which is plastic commonly known as PVC. PVC is a popular polymer used in everything from construction pipes to flooring to clothing and furniture. The basic raw material for polyvinyl chloride are salt and oil. The general breakdown is 57% chlorine, made from industrial salt, and 43% carbon from oil gas via ethylene. While black records are standard, the PVC used to make records is actually clear. It's actually a polycarbonate additive, carbon black, which makes many of the records we encounter black. One effect of this additive is a smoother flow and therefore lower noise floor. This is likely why black records are still the new black. Everything old is new again. It is calculated that 8 companies in Germany now turning out vinyl records. There are 23 in the United States, 10 in Britain, and 2 each in France and Italy. Around the world, sales of vinyl records are at their highest since 1997. Last year, 4.6 million vinyl records were sold in the United States, nearly 500% more than 5 years earlier. In Britain, 400,000 vinyl records were sold, a 50% increase. Across the globe, the industry reckons that sales of vinyl adds up to $171 million compared with $55 million 5 years earlier. That is a good rise in anyone's book. Increasingly, as the market for vinyl records grows, the owners of discarded pressing machines realize that they can command a price, so the price of a machine has skyrocketed. The going rate for an old machine is about $25,000. Not bad for a discarded metal in the corner of a warehouse. More and more people like the vinyl experience. It's not a digitally dead sound. There's a warm sound to it, and there is an appeal of vinyl that is a more active way of listening to music. Some people like the experience of having to get up from their chair, putting the record on the player, and adjusting the stylus. These people are not nerds. They love vinyl. Some are spending a lot of money for the record players. So what is behind the renewed love for the old format? It may be similar to the appeal of books. Who can doubt the convenience and logic of carrying a library around on a computer card? But books do persist, probably in part because people like the feel of them. It's the triumph of old technology. You may think the market is one predominantly of aging people, the classic record nerd, but actually it's much younger, often people too young to remember the original vinyl heyday. While the poll shows that the 35 to 40 year range of people are the largest consumer group, which represents 28.5%, younger buyers are also seeing the appeal of the format, with over a third, 35.3%, under the age of 35. Just under the half of the respondents were married, and men made up the majority of the self-selecting samples, 87.4%. There was one particular intriguing result. It also appears that the appeal of the vinyl isn't just limited to those with a turntable. 3.7% of the respondents said they bought it despite not owning one. That means they are collectors. So the new technology is not necessarily all digital. Analog has its virtues. And as you can see, there is a return to some of the technology that is analog, which is superior to digital. I looked at my audio equipment that I haven't used in a while, and sitting there is a Thorin's turntable, which is a very high-end unit that I've had many years ago, and now I find it's worth quite a bit. And people are now buying brand new turntables. And such an example is the Technics. There's a new Technics called the SL1200GR turntable, and I was in for a shock. The price for this turntable seems to have been, while it's not as expensive as last year's reissue, is not quite as cheap as some might had hoped. According to Gizmodo, the new standard model of this revamped SL1200 that was announced last week will cost $2,300 in Canada, which roughly translates to $2,000 in U.S. money. Last year's 1200 model was $4,000 each. The news will come as a blow to Technics fans looking to replace their old 1200. It is possible to get a pair of Pioneer PLX 1000 turntables for much less. Technics unveiled standard version of its updated SL1200 turntable. Earlier this week, Technics creative director told the New York Times why the company has turned away from DJs and towards the audiophile market with its reissue line of turntables. "Our concept is analog records for hi-fi listening." He said DJs are fine too, but as a marketing target, it's problematic. "We don't want to sell the 1200 as the best tool for DJing. The 1200 is a 1200. Despite the high price tag, the initial run of last year's limited 1200 GAE sold out in under 30 minutes when it went on sale in Japan. Wow, let me dig out my old hi-fi equipment. Kodak brings back a classic with Ektachrome. This revival to analog technology is not just limited to vinyl records. The list of discontinued film stocks is lengthy, and after Kodak pulled the plug on our beloved Kodachrome, it seemed likely any film could be next on the chopping block. But perhaps those dark days are behind us, because today Kodak announced the company will be bringing back a different film stock, Ektachrome. It was discontinued in 2012. Kodak's decision to raise it from the dead is directly related to a recent increase in demand for analog film. Yep, you heard that right. So does this mean that film photography is about to start down a similar path of revival as we've seen from vinyl records? Maybe, which are currently selling at a 25-year high. I sure wouldn't mind. And this was an announcement from Kodak. Sales of professional photographic films have been steadily rising over the last few years, with professionals and enthusiasts rediscovering the artistic control offered by manual processes and the creative satisfaction of a physical end product. The reintroduction of one of the most iconic films is supported by the growing popularity of analog photography and a resurgence in shooting film. Resurgence in the popularity of analog photography has created demand for new and old film products alike. Ektachrome is a color reversal film and was developed in the early 1940s, used for decades by the National Geographic photographers. It's been long favored and due to its fine grain and excellent color reproduction. So come the end of 2017, you'll once again will be able to pick up a 35mm roll of it, and you'll likely got a bearded, glasses-wearing hipster with a turntable to thank for that. So what do you think of the prospect of analog revival of film? Hey, wait a minute. I got to pull out all my old Nikon film cameras. I really enjoyed using that equipment. Not limiting the announcement to the revival of Ektachrome film, Kodak released an upgraded and enhanced version of a Kodak Super 8 camera. It was first launched in 1965. The Kodak Super 8 format was one of the most influential developments in amateur filmmaking, and now it's back with First launched in 1965, Kodak Super 8 format was one of the most influential development in amateur filmmaking, and now it's back with an all-new kind of camera. The news is that Kodak is enabling the next generation of filmmakers with access to an upgraded and enhanced version of the same analog technology. From its beginnings as a home movie media of the 60s, today's Super 8mm film is alive and well and making it possible for virtually anyone to bring the unmistakable look and feel of real film to the screen. More than 50 years after its introduction, this small gauge film still provides an easy, inexpensive way for students, enthusiasts to work at film resolutions and color depths. The following is a reaction by Steven Spielberg to the Kodak announcement. "When I watch the news, I expect and I want it to look like live television. However, I don't want that in my movies. I want our century-plus medium to keep its filmic look, and I like seeing very fine, swimming grain up there on the screen. To me, it's just more alive, and it imbues an image with mystery, so it's never literal. I love movies that aren't literally up in my face, with images so clear there's nothing left to our imagination. Had I shot it on a digital camera, the Omaha beach landings in Saving Private Ryan would have crossed the line for those that found them almost unbearable. Paintings done on a computer and paintings done on a canvas requires an artist to make us feel something. To be the cursor or the brush, that's the question. And certainly both can produce remarkable results, but doesn't that same hold true for the cinematic arts? Digital or celluloid? Viva la difference. Shouldn't both be made available for an artist to choose?"
Excuse me for interrupting, Hank, but something was bothering me. That clickety-clack in the background kept reminding me of something, and then suddenly I remembered, Everything Old is New Again. 1940s, maybe as late as the late 40s, early 50s, on the radio, a man named Walter Winchell. Everybody listened to him. It was the most widely listened to show in 1948. And what did he do between segments when he was changing the news story? Clickety-clack. The typewriter, that was Walter Winchell. He was the journalist who was the journalist on the radio, and he went clickety-clack, clickety-clack. He also opened up with, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, on all the ships at sea." Everything that's old is good again, new again.
In a little more than 90 days from now, it is a deadline for filing your income tax return by April 18th. Now is the time to think about what tax prep software is available. The state tax filing due dates for income tax returns and tax extensions where there is an income tax are not necessarily the same as the federal due dates. For most states, it is April 18th. There are exceptions. Delaware, Hawaii, Iowa, Louisiana, and Virginia have later deadlines. Why is tax day April 18th? The regular tax return filing deadline is April 15th. However, due to April 15th being on a Saturday, Emancipation Day holiday being observed on April 17th instead of the 16th, tax day is on the following Tuesday. Not wanting to wait until the last minute, I decided to take a quick look at what tax preparations are available. There is TurboTax from Intuit. There is Tax Cut from H&R Block. And then there is Tax Act. Other than 1040EZ, which is free from all three publishers, there is a trial version of Tax Act that works online. The cost is about one half of that for TurboTax for the same equivalent functions. Since Tax Act is lower cost, I decided to do a trial run, but it's available only online. Tax Act asks if you want to import information that's readily available on TurboTax PDF files from last year's data. I chose to import data from TurboTax return from 2015. I was surprised that after the import conversion, Tax Act requested the input of basic information such as first name, last name, and okay, I provided the data for the first page, but then it continued for each succeeding page requesting more basic information that was already on the past TurboTax return. At that point, I opted to go no further. Since I had been online with TaxCut, I could not find any way to delete the created account, which contained personal data. Lesson learned. Don't, and I repeat, don't run any trial application online if the data itself cannot be deleted. If you're doing your own taxes, here's what's available. TurboTax from Intuit, TaxCut from H&R Block, Tax Act, Jackson Hewitt, and TaxSlayer. Don't wait until the very last minute to choose the right online tax preparation program. The right service for you should balance your requirement for ease of use and affordability. It also has to meet the needs of your particular financial situation. Cloud-based personal tax preparation applications make it easy to do your taxes in chunks. They organize and store the data you entered, and they even offer to take you to the screen where you left off. Depending on the solution you choose, you may also be able to move back and forth among your desktop, tablet, and smartphone. It's not just this portability that makes online tax preparation preferable to the old paper method. The sites do all the calculations required and fill in the forms and schedules you need, print them out, or e-file them. The free versions are almost all limited to 1040EZ. Personal tax preparation website designers have created multiple versions of their applications so you don't have to pay for more or less than your financial situation requires. Three of the products rounded up here even let you prepare and file your income taxes free of charge, both federal and state, if you only need to submit a 1040EZ. These include Jackson Hewitt Free Edition, Tax Act Free, and TurboTax Federal Free Edition. H&Block charges per state return filed and one state return using TaxSlayer Free Basic Edition. All except Jackson Hewitt offers a mobile app to accommodate these simple returns. With the exception of TaxSlayer, the companies included here offer three other versions that add support for more advanced tax situations. Top-of-the-line applications from each company typically provides all the forms and schedules needed for the self-employed and proprietor of small businesses. By the way, when they say self-employed, you do part-time work, you're self-employed. But only TaxSlayer Classic contains all IRS forms and schedules designed for individual taxpayers, including Schedule C. If you're self-employed and want to claim that income and all of its related expenses, you can't use the Jackson Hewitt Deluxe Edition. Tax Act Plus, up until this year, offered comprehensive support for federal forms and schedules for free. There are other differences. All of the personal tax preparation apps we view here allow you to import data from 2015 returns. Only TurboTax and H&R Block have smartphone apps that cover the same ground as the browser-based versions. All of the services offer some help if you're audited, but only H&R Block helps you prepare and send an agent to attend the audit with you. Prices vary a great deal. TurboTax Deluxe only promises the cost of its state version until the March 18th. In other words, TurboTax Deluxe state version available only until March 18th for free. And while you've been answering simple questions about your tax-related income and expense, these sites have been preparing the actual IRS forms and schedules in the background. The 1040 and all the forms and schedules identified by letters or numbers that you submit by electronically are being prepared in the background. Tax preparation websites provide the simplest, clearest way to fulfill your annual obligation to the IRS and to your state tax agency where it's applicable. They try to help you find all reportable income and deductible expenses, and they do so in ways that make the massive and sometimes murky tax code more understandable. They're not for everyone, though. You may find that your financial situation is too complex or just simply too nervous to prepare your own taxes, even with the help of a tax preparation service. So sometimes it's worth spending the extra money to hire a professional. And for Mac OS X users, there is TurboTax and H&R Block Tax Cut. Note, if you are self-employed and you need to file a Schedule C, you must purchase the higher-end Home and Business Edition, as the deluxe versions is the same as for Windows. It's no longer includes Schedule C and Home Office Deduction modules. Regardless whether you're on Windows or on a Mac, frequent online tax code update prompts are common when you launch the program. Tax law changes, often during last-minute legislative changes during the tax prep season. Minor corrections to IRS implementation and software bug fixes necessitates endless tweaks to the forms, help files, and code. You start keying in your income, expense, and deductions early. Keep current on all these updates each time you return to the program to enter more info that you've gathered. What's new in 3D printer technology in 2017? There's a company by the name of Ability 3D. They promise to let hobbyists print with metal. Printing metal has been one of the holy grails of 3D printing. For the most part, printed prototype parts are made of plastic or other soft materials that greatly limits their use in many production applications. Unless you pony up for a bank vault size unit that can print metal and cost a few $100,000, you'll wind up with parts that may be useful for low-stress situations. For production, or for high-stress or high-temperature situations like engines, you need to resort to traditional means of fabrication, usually machining. Ability 3D is hoping to change that with a $3,000 unit that can fit on a workbench and can use a variety of metal. It is a combination welder and machine tool. Cleverly, Ability's printer uses an MIG welder to heat and extrude the metal substrate. Technically, the company says it can potentially work with any form of metal that can be welded, but for now they're focused on steel, aluminum, and stainless steel. But in each case, the printer is fed from spools of appropriate welding wire. Like most metal printing solutions, to get smooth surfaces, the extrusion unit needs to be coupled with a machine tool that can route out holes as needed and finish off surfaces. The printer can create items up to 8 inches on the side, although anything that large will take quite a bit of time. Next month, Ability 3D plans to print an engine cylinder and install it into a working engine. If it can do that without having to do a lot of work on the part of it after it's printed, that will be a huge milestone. However, if they can pull it off, they definitely open a new chapter in what's possible for small business and high-end hobbyists. It's not likely to put a dent in high-volume manufacturing, though, as the company estimates that the cylinder would take between 10 to 20 hours to print. Home 3D printing got some bad press after poor performances of much-hyped MakerBot, but for those willing to take some initiative, there are numerous affordable solutions suitable for at least prototyping. While Ability 3D has set a target price of $3,000, timing is dependent on the success of its Kickstarter project. It sounds like there's plenty of challenges left, but the promise of affordable 3D printing in metal makes it worthwhile watching closely. The DaVinci Nano is a plug-and-play D3 printer that only costs $230. XYZ Printing is the company that produces it. They're known for offering a variety of 3D printers, some of which rivals the likes of MakerBot's Replicator line and other high-end hardware. But the company also has been making some that are both portable and affordable, as was in the case with its sub-$300 DaVinci Mini. By introducing the DaVinci Nano, a full-fledged 3D printer priced for only $230, the machine is designed for people who are new to the technology. XYZ Printing says the idea is not to compromise on the feature and overall quality of the product. Since the DaVinci Nano is being pitched as a plug-and-play 3D printer, Windows 10 PC users won't have to worry about installing any drivers to get it up and running. XYZ Printing also made things easier by adding auto-calibration and auto-leveling, which should simplify dealing with PLA filaments. Unfortunately, the DaVinci Mini Nano won't be available until later in the year, but it's worth keeping in mind in case you're looking for a 3D printer that won't break your wallet or break your bank. As more companies focus on technology, career opportunities grow outside of the Silicon Valley area. Growth rates for jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math, which is called STEM, are surging. In fact, STEM-related jobs are expected to grow 1.7 times faster than non-STEM jobs between 2010 and 2020, and this is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. With the expansion of this specialized labor force, STEM talent has a lot to consider, from job potential to research opportunities to the cost of living when considering where to send your resume. According to the 2016 WalletHub survey, the usual suspects are, of course, where Silicon Valley thrives, Austin, Texas, a growing tech hub, and Seattle, where it's home to Expedia and others, are among the top cities for STEM jobs. However, there are other U.S. cities you may not have thought about when it comes to STEM positions. While certainly not a complete list, here are five unexpected U.S. cities with growing opportunities for careers in STEM. I was very surprised at what the first one listed was. Hoboken, New Jersey. Among the most strollable cities in the nation, Hoboken has been dubbed a walker's paradise, just across the river from New York City, without the city's high price tag. This North Jersey town is home to the STEM-friendly Stevens Institute of Technology, one of the oldest tech universities in the country, and companies such as e-commerce business, Jet.com. Future unicorns connect at Hoboken's local New Jersey tech meetups, which bills itself as New Jersey's largest entrepreneurial and startup community. And innovators take note. The city recently hosted the first Propeller Fest, a massive networking day for tech companies and entrepreneurs. Tech salaries for software engineers average more than $95,000. Cost of living, about approximately $2,300 for a one-bedroom to $3,000 per month for a two-bedroom apartment. Outdoor activities can be found at Church Square Park, Columbus Park, Elysian Park, and Stevens Park. The city also sports a portion of Hudson River Waterfront Walkway, Pier A, Pier 13, and there are plenty of bike paths. As far as arts and culture goes, Hoboken beats much of the competition when it comes to the number of restaurants and bars. The city is a destination for festivals, including the renowned St. Patrick's Day Parade, Feast of St. Anthony, St. Anne's Feast, and Hoboken's Italian Festival. And in sports, well, it may not have any professional team, but it's just a 10-minute subway ride from New York City, Madison Square Garden, home of the New York Rangers, Knicks, and Liberty, or a 15-minute train ride to soccer's New York Red Bulls. Next on the list of cities with growing STEM opportunities is Reston, Virginia. It's located right outside the action of Washington, D.C., easily accessible via the Capitol Beltway or Washington Dulles International Airport. Reston, Virginia was named the seventh best place to live in America by CNN and Money. The city has become an unexpected hotbed for STEM talent, housing some of the country's leading companies within a low cost of living and easy access to the nation's capital. The first planned residential community in the state, Reston has become part of Silicon Hill, or the Silicon Valley of the East. Tech salaries for software engineers averages $101,000, senior software engineer averages $107,000, business analyst averages $92,000, and programmer analyst averages $89,000. There are restaurants, entertainment, and other services are 1% below the national average, while groceries, healthcare, and utilities are only slightly above that. In terms of outdoor activities, there's 1,350 acres of open space, include beautiful Lake Fairfax Park, two golf courses, and Washington and Old Dominion trails. And if you're looking for art and culture, community-wide events include the Day After Thanksgiving Parade at the Reston Town Center and the Reston Triathlon. And for theater buffs, the Reston Community Players present four productions annually in the Reston Community Center. And for sports, well, you can hop over to the Capitol. Washington, D.C. is home to the Wizards, Capitals, and Nationals. The Steel City isn't just about steel mills and Pittsburgh sports. The second most livable city in the United States, according to CNN, and it has been attracting top STEM talent for years thanks to a shift towards jobs in robotics, healthcare, nuclear engineering, and biotech, with companies such as Google, Apple, Facebook, Uber, Nokia, and IBM having a large presence, along with Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has become one of the largest destinations for STEM employment in the United States. In fact, a 2014 paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research named this Western Pennsylvania city the second best in the country for intergenerational economic mobility. Here's a fun fact. Pittsburgh is the birthplace of the first Smiley, created by a Carnegie Mellon University computer scientist in 1982. Tech salaries? Mechanical engineer averages $67,000 a year. Electrical engineer averages $70,000. Senior software engineer averages $95,000. Cost of living. As of July 2016, the average rent for a one-bedroom apartment ranged from $1,295 per month, 10 miles outside the city, to 1163. Outdoor activities? The location on the Allegheny Plateau yields access to three rivers, Allegheny, Mulligahella, I hope I pronounced that correctly, and the Ohio River. Due to many of the neighborhoods being sloped because of the area's vast mountain region, it offers scenic trails for hiking, walking, and biking. Arts and culture in Pittsburgh is not lacking at all. There's a Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, Pittsburgh Opera, Andy Warhol Museum, and the Carnegie Museum of Art, the Frick Art and Historical Center. Sports, well, say no more. The Pittsburgh Steelers, the Pirates, the Penguins, and between the three teams they have combined for 15 titles, most recently when the Penguins won the Stanley Cup in 2016. Next on the list is Syracuse, New York. This upstate New York City is transitioning its economy from an industrial and manufacturing hub into a service area, with STEM talent on the rise thanks to top employers such as Syracuse University, Upstate Medical University, Wegmans Food Markets, Lockheed Martin, Bristol Myers, and a division of Time Warner Cable, not to mention the growing base of small businesses. Home to the country's longest-running state fair, 1848, Syracuse was highlighted by Forbes as one of the top 10 places to raise a family in 2010. The area also ranked in the top 20 of U.S. News' best places to live for quality of life, thanks to its shorter-than-average commute time. Tech salaries. Operations manager averaging $64,000 a year, mechanical engineer averaging $67,000 a year. Cost of living. Rent in Syracuse is one of the more reasonable on this list. As of July 2016, a one-bedroom apartment ranged from $717 to $843 per month. That's according to Rent Jungle. Outdoor activities? There's over 170 parks, fields, and recreation areas, which includes Burnett Park, the first public golf course in the United States. Other favorites? 12 public pools, 2 public ice rinks, and 2 public 9-hole golf courses. And as art and culture goes, there's the Syracuse Jazz Festival, Polish Festival, the Syracuse Opera Company, the Syracuse Shakespeare Festival, Erie Canal Museum, Milton J. Rubenstein Museum of Science and Technology. And in sports, Syracuse University is home to the basketball and football team that each draws more than 30,000 fans per game. And who are some of the alumni? Jim Brown, Larry Zonka, Carmelo Anthony, and both teams play at the Carrier Dome, consistently ranked as among the hardest places in the country for an opponent to compete, thanks to its large size and very loud hometown crowd. Rounding out the list of cities where STEM jobs are readily available is Northwest Arkansas. I would scratch my head and say, where is that? Until I realize what Northwest Arkansas is. It's the home of Walmart. Nestled in the Ozark Mountains, an outdoor enthusiast playground, Northwest Arkansas is a little region with a lot to offer and has been dubbed the number 3 best place to live in the United States by U.S. News & World Report and home to the world's largest retailer. Walmart has several open positions for technologists. Northwest Arkansas is in the midst of a cultural transformation that positions the city for extreme growth. For technologists, I can't even pronounce it properly, specifically, NWA boasts an up-and-coming startup scene with a council dedicated to technology and intentional focus on nurturing mobile and internet startups. Early adopters are welcome. Tech salaries. Programmer analyst averages $72,000 a year. System analyst averages $89,000 a year. And senior manager averages $102,000 a year. Cost of living per capita is 10% above the national average. Outdoor activities? There's over 200 miles of bike trails, canoeing, caving, fishing, rock climbing, and more. Art and culture? There's Crystal Bridge Museum of Art, Fayetteville Roots Festival, Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue, First Thursday on the Square, and Fayetteville Underground. And sports? What Arkansas lacks in a professional team, the University of Arkansas makes up for it. Don't believe it? Just attend a regular Southeast Conference football game.
You know, the whole subject of STEM gets a little bit confusing because economists and geographers and people like that take STEM as a single thing. When you're looking for a job, when you're a new graduate or a job hunter, there is no such thing as STEM. What you're looking for is a job as a programmer, as a mathematician, as an engineer, as a whatever. Nowadays, the major corporations, and that's who we're really talking about in analyzing and looking at these different cities, the major corporations aren't just looking for a programmer or a this or a that. They're looking for somebody highly specialized, somebody who knows how to get on the floor running and working with the type of CRM or the type of database management that that company is invested in. It's not that simple. I'm sorry. It's just not that simple. It's very hard to get a job these days.
In the news, Hasselblad acquired by DJI. Well, who is DJI? DJI is a Chinese technology company headquartered in Shenzhen, Guangdong. It manufactures unmanned aerial vehicles, also known as drones. And that was a big surprise. The Hasselblad was associated with the NASA space projects. Models of the Hasselblad went to the moon and back, recording images of the Earth from the moon, and they were legendary in the eyes of thousands of photographers. Well, a lot has happened to Hasselblad since then. With the advent of digital imaging in the late 90s, Hasselblad was left behind in the analog days. At that time, there were several digital camera back makers, and all of these companies made digital backs that could be attached to the Hasselblad cameras. At some point in early 2000s, Hasselblad went on the market looking for a buyer. Some digital camera companies tried to purchase Hasselblad, but in the end, it was bought by Imacon, a film scanner company. In November of 2002, Hasselblad released the H1 camera system. It was revolutionary at the time, as it was Hasselblad's new medium format camera. Digital camera backmakers like Phase One, Sinar, Leaf, and others started to design their camera backs to fit the new H1 system. Companies like Phase One focus on making digital backs, while companies like Hasselblad focus on creating state-of-the-art cameras. Everyone at that point was happy. Then one day, the CEO of Hasselblad thought up of a grand scheme to put the other digital camera backmakers out of business. Overnight, Hasselblad integrated their cameras and digital backs and no longer allow other camera companies to attach their digital backs to the Hasselblad cameras. If a company wanted to attach a different camera back to their camera, you have to ask them and you got to get permission, pay a licensing fee. Many digital backmakers had no choice but to ante up, as they had no other cameras to which they can attach their digital backs. It became a matter of survival for many photographers in the industry. Hasselblad's move was not well received in the industry, as many photographers prefer Phase One's digital backs with their Hasselblad camera. In the end, this scheme turned out the beginning of the end for Hasselblad. Over the next couple of years, Hasselblad was bought and sold a few times. They changed CEOs almost every 2 years and ventured off into crazy camera land. Along the way, Hasselblad, the brand, continued to hemorrhage money. Finally, with a new CEO, they refocused the company's effort on the H6 camera line and the development of a new system, the X1D. On June 22nd of last year, Hasselblad announced an amazing new camera that took the camera industry by storm and confirmed hopes that, well, perhaps Hasselblad was back. And many photographers were thrilled to see it. They introduced a brand new camera with a revolutionary design, a medium format, mirrorless camera, and a lens line to go with it, designed with typical Swedish form and function. The X1D is very attractive, reasonably priced, compact, and quite lightweight, and with an incredible innovative touchscreen interface. The camera was so intuitive, you did not need a manual. The bottom line is, Hasselblad had a hit on their hands. Unfortunately, having a hit is not always a good thing. Orders began to pour in, more orders than they had anticipated. But the company was both cash poor and resource poor. They simply did not have much money in the bank after losing millions of dollars for several years. Hasselblad needed money to produce the cameras that the photographers were ordering. They went to investors, but they didn't have any more to give. They finally found a minority investor in DJI. Well, we all know that DJI as the wildly successful Chinese drone manufacturer, and DJI put more money in and became the majority shareholder. And, well, let's skip ahead to this year. It's now January, and Hasselblad is just beginning to deliver the X1D in small quantities. DJI now owns a majority share of Hasselblad. T-Mobile will credit low data users $10 a month. The kickback program applies only to T-Mobile One unlimited data customers who use less than 2 gigabytes of data a month. T-Mobile CEO John Legere announced at a press conference at CES 2017 that T-Mobile will credit low data users $10 a month, and T-Mobile is making the case that you should be on its unlimited data plan, even if all you do is view photos of your grandchildren. T-Mobile, the nation's third largest carrier, introduced its kickback program designed to give customers who don't use a lot of data a credit of $10 a month. It only applies to T-Mobile One unlimited data customers who use less than 2 gigabytes of data a month, or roughly 8 hours of streaming video. The move is a direct response to criticism T-Mobile faced after introduced T-Mobile One. The company was pushing to move to a single unlimited data rate plan, but faced criticism that it eliminated more affordable options for people who don't need that data. While $10 off of a $70 individual plan isn't much, the savings are significant if you have a large family, or on the T-Mobile plan. After 4 lines, which costs $140, it costs $20 to add a 5th line, and so on. For folks on those additional lines who don't use much data, such as your grandparents, that cost is only $10 a month. The plan is similar to Google's Project Fi wireless service, which gives you credit for the data you don't use in a given month, where T-Mobile gives you a flat $10 back. Public service announcements. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, that's tomorrow, January the 12th at 7 p.m. Topic of presentation is Printer Technology in 2017. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 401. Photo ID is required. BCUG, the Brookdale Computer Users Group, will have a presentation on how to harden a wood browser from attack, and their presentation is on Thursday, tomorrow, January the 12th, starting time at 6:45 p.m. They will meet at the Middleton Library in Middleton, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on FBI security, Friday, February the 3rd, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on 5 mistakes to avoid on your website, Tuesday, February the 7th, meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Location is Danbury Hospital Auditorium, Danbury, Connecticut. And the biggie that's coming up is TCF 42, the original personal computer festival at the College of New Jersey. It's an all-day event, Saturday, March the 18th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The keynote theme will be autonomous vehicle. And if you want more information, go to tcf-nj.org. It's on a Saturday. I hope to be there, and I hope to see all of you there. In the next segment, we will present something a little different. Marty Winston and I had been discussing the effects of ELF, or extremely low frequency. The term ELF is used in reference to electromagnetic fields having frequencies much lower than the frequencies of signals typically used in communications. Marty's conducting an experiment for measuring soil moisture. If you can follow along, we welcome your 2 cents on the subject with your email to pcradio@pcradioshow.org.
Okay, guys, I may need your help with this. As some of you know, we have a proof of concept editorial project house going up. And one of the elements that I recently came really to worry about is the ability to measure soil moisture. The professional landscaper who's donating services to this house told me that in decades of his practice, and he's a veteran, he's never found a reliable soil moisture probe. And that got me to thinking. Stay tuned. We're going to get very electronic in a second. I had friends 50 years ago who were following the example of something they read about in one of the magazines, might have been Popular Electronics, where one guy took a signal source and planted a couple of rods in the soil where he was, and another guy some distance away took a set of high-impedance headphones and put a couple of probes in the ground where he was, and they could hear each other. That's not really audio going through the ground. That's ELF, extremely low frequency radio. And it has some special characteristics that come into play here. But I thought, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting concept, sending very low frequency audio kind of band radio signals through the ground. 50 years ago, my cousin and a friend of ours who lived about 3 blocks away tried to duplicate that what that article suggested. And not all those articles were based on real things really happening, if you know what I mean. So the friend put a couple of stakes in the ground, maybe 18 inches, 2 feet long and separated by a few yards, and drove those with a speaker output from a little tabletop in a 50s era, a little tabletop reel-to-reel tape player. My cousin at his home put a couple of similar stakes into the ground and took a crystal headphone, a high-impedance earphone. Yeah, guys, that's before earbuds. And hooked that up, and he could hear the music from our friend's house about 3 blocks away. And that was interesting. Now, I talked to them both recently. They're not sure it went the full 3 blocks. I just remember them telling me back then, they could have been fibbing, that it went the full 3 blocks. But I looked it up. I did some research on it. And I found that other ELF experiments have shown that a constant tone was easier to propagate than modulation. And if you had both, a constant tone plus modulation, you could pick up the modulation. And I thought, you know, I may be able to make something out of this that is very useful, ignoring the modulation. My thought is this: propagation through the atmosphere or through the ground of radio has a lot of variables involved with how much signal strength gets to the far end, if any. And I have to believe that for a ground-based ELF radio, and that's not Santa's helpers doing a broadcast, for ELF, extremely low-frequency radio run through the ground, I have to believe that soil moisture content is going to have an impact on the received signal strength. So here's what I think can happen, and I'm hoping that one or more of you are hobbyists enough, breadboarders enough, that you can tool this up and make it work and let me know, and I'll give you a lot of credit and get it turned into this major media project that we're doing in our 40-year house. Here's the idea. You start with, initially, just for experimentation, a pair of rods yards apart. What I intend to do is to go underneath the foundation, drive a ground stake down into the ground down there, run a cable up from that, and maybe 20-foot diameter circle of metal band around it, also buried, a wire coming out of that. My hope is that that configuration will prove to be at ELF frequencies an omnidirectional, horizontally polarized antenna. Some of you guys who are into radio will know better than me, but I'm hoping that proves to be right. If I can drive that, and of course, with the two wires coming out of the ground, there's some room to experiment with what exactly that takes. If I can drive that with a signal at some constant frequency, now I'm going to take it out of the audio band people can hear. I'm thinking maybe 40 kilohertz, which is ultrasonic, but above what is going to annoy your household pets, but it might annoy some outdoor pets, and that would be a good thing. Again, it's not audio, it's electronic, but sometimes you've got things down there like rocks and minerals that might act like little crystal sets, and let them be annoyed by it, and if that makes the fire ants or the moles and voles go away, that's fine with me. On the receiving end, I'm thinking in each of the sprinkling irrigation zones of the house, we can put a couple of stakes in the ground a few yards apart. They can be fully in the ground, and it should still work in just a matter of trenching some wire. And, of course, since there's wiring out to sprinkler heads, we've got a route for it that won't be constantly getting chopped up. My thought is, to duplicate what they did in those days with the crystal set, which is a very high impedance earphone. Not a crystal set, a crystal earbud. What do we call them? Headphone, I guess. The idea is to use a field effect transistor, which has, again, a very high impedance input. A field effect transistor with a circuit that is a passband for around 40 kilohertz, doesn't have to be exactly that, turns into a signal strength meter at the point you take the amount of the amplitude of the signal you're receiving and digitize it, and it can be a single byte, and that would be fine. If that single byte is something we can communicate back to control systems, that should give us a relative, or at least a coarse, measurement of the degree of soil moisture content, and we really only have to know a few levels. You know, it's sop and wet, make it dry. It's bone dry, make it wet. It's somewhere in the middle, those kinds of levels. And it also strikes me that there's a lot of dependency. If I'm one zone away from the middle of the house where the antenna is, then I'm going to get a different kind of response than if I were 5, 10, 20 zones away, because all of the interceding zones are going to impact the field strength at the final zone. Well, it occurs to me that empirical calibration, in other words, dumping, testing, measuring, and storing, might be a way to make it work anyway. Initially, you take the closest zone, you find out what it measures when it's dry, you dump a bucket of water on it, you find out what it measures then, you let that go to kind of midway, and you try the next zone out, and you do those measurements, and the next zone out, and you do those measurements. If you're putting all of that into a simple database, it should be fairly easy to ultimately profile what the signal in each zone means for that zone, especially taking into account the signals in the zones en route. So I believe we have a potentially economical, widespread, single-source, multiple-endpoint way to measure soil moisture content, but I am unable, with the facilities I have, to prototype that. So if one of you is up to it, again, I'm suggesting 40 kilohertz as a signal frequency, an FET-based amplifier providing a signal strength reading that is passbanded at 40 kilohertz and then digitized. Not only it has to be a tight passband, you just want to take, submarine communication signals and get them out of there. And if you find some at 40, then pick another frequency, you know. But if you guys can prototype, show what works and give it some tweaks, you know, what's it take to make it better, I would very much appreciate it. Drop a note here to the show. They'll get it to me, and I'll come back and talk about it more. If you don't mind, give me your contact info. We may end up doing a special report on you. This is Marty Winston, the News Tips Guy, and that's as well-grounded as I am today. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty.
Wow, that was pretty heavy, Marty. You know, when I was in high school, when I was in grade school, you know, at the back of the comic books, they used to have these specials for sale for mail order for kids. And I remember there was one where for 99 cents, I could get a radio. Unbelievable. So I, of course, figured out how to paste 2 quarters and 2 dimes and a couple of nickels and a few pennies onto a piece of cardboard and mail it into the address I was given. And I got back a kit with very detailed instructions on how to put it together. It consisted of a crystal and a cat's whisker and a pair of earplugs, earphones, whatever. Anybody remember what a cat's whisker was? A very thin piece of metal, wire that you controlled your crystal radio with. And I put it all together and I was amazed. I was able to listen to WEAF, which today is NBC. Fascinating. Did I understand what it was all about? No, but they gave a little booklet with it in fairly basic language explaining the physics and so on and electronics of the radio that I had just built. Marty, I don't know, but I don't think that I'm capable of building the prototype that you're asking for. But I'll pass this along to my brother-in-law, who is not only a graduate engineer, but a full-time farmer. It might be interesting to him.
The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay warm. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.